Acknowledgements to my amanuensis, Giovanni Ciccati. First of all, I want to join everyone else in thanking John and Jeremy for arranging this very nice event. I guess I would say, by way of introduction, it's not rare to have very bright and productive scientists, but it's a lot more rare to have those people be genuine and warm human beings at the same time. Present company accepted, of course. As was alluded to, and perhaps you can infer by 20th century technology here, Ray and I go back a very long time. It must be over 30 years. I've known Stu a little less long. I guess I met him here when I spent a sabbatical in 1979 during an ice age. and I don't think Stu knows this. Where is Stu? Yeah. But he had a very important role to play in my scientific production. It had nothing to do with knots or random walks or anything like that. He introduced me to Sanders of the River, which is a boy's own adventure, which I found an excellent way to, as an antidote for the stresses and strain of struggling with theoretical problems. So, I'll say more about Ray tonight at the banquet, so let me start on this. I'm willing to accept bribes in the meantime. Okay, so you can read the title both in its original version and the shortened version, and I want to say at the outset that this is work from the Paris side of my schizophrenic life, and it's work done together with Oren Burkhardt at École Normale, Len Stederbaum at Heidelberg, Ricardo Spezia, who was a postdoc at ENS, and João Malalo, who's a current graduate student at ENS. So what is this all about and why should we care? I'll give you a little bit of introduction to the problem, and I'm going to illustrate it by a simple type of chemical reaction, a cis-trans isomerization, where we have a rotation about a double bond. Those of you who have forgotten your chemistry, it's rather easy to rotate about a single chemical bond, but if you have a double chemical bond, that second bond comes from the overlap of p orbitals on the two carbons, and if you try to do the isomerization, you're going to lose that bond, so it costs lots of energy. So it's quite a difficult reaction to do in the ground electronic state. Let me stick low tech. But what one can do in a photochemical reaction is to excite to the first electronically excited state, and the image in the past has been exactly the one I'm showing you, that then you could do the twisting motion, and then you would have a radiationless transition to convert from the excited state down to the ground state and produce the trans product. Cis, of course, looks like this, and trans looks like that. And if you don't understand that, you can consult the well-known Latin scholar, Professor Whittington. Okay. Now, how fast should this process be? if you think in this way, then there's a fairly large energy gap between these two states, and it's difficult to dump a lot of energy into the environment when you do this process, so it should be somewhat slow. And one expected that the time scale should be something like many picoseconds for this process. Now, with the development of ultra-fast experimental techniques, femtosecond spectroscopy in particular, one could actually go in and see how long these processes took. And it wasn't many picoseconds at all. It was about 200 to 500 femtoseconds, several hundreds of femtoseconds, extremely rapid. So that's completely inconsistent with this picture. And the answer to the difficulty was with the idea of a conical intersection. Now, conical intersections go back in the physics literature to the 1930s. Some fairly heavy names like Eugene Wigner and Edward Teller and so on. But they hadn't penetrated very much into the chemistry community until this kind of thing was discovered in the last decade or so. And what's the picture in the new picture? Namely, that we shouldn't think in single dimension like this, but we should think in terms of two dimensions, and I'll describe in more detail what those dimensions are in a moment. But when you do that, you can get to a situation where, under certain conditions, the excited electronic state and the ground electronic state become degenerate. Okay, essentially there's no coupling splitting the two states apart. And then that provides something like what's called a funnel, a photochemical funnel, to rapidly go from the excited electronic state to the ground electronic state and produce the desired product. Interesting scientific sociology is that these were more or less ignored in chemistry until about a decade ago now, and now people think it's the only thing that happens in the excited electronic state. People think they're everywhere. The truth is, of course, somewhere in between, but these are very important. And their importance is such is that they're called often transition states for photochemical reactions. Now, they're not barriers, right? We're not going up in energy to go over a barrier. We're going down to a region of a point to get to the ground electronic state. Now, what I'm going to talk about is the influence of an environment on these things. And I'll just show you some experimental results having to do with some biophysical isomerization in a protein environment. And the experimental time scale associated with this process in a protein environment is something like a couple hundred femtoseconds. If I switch to a polar solution, that lengthens to about 10 picoseconds. So the environment clearly matters for these things. Okay. That's a bit of background. The goals of what we're trying to do are the following. What we want to do first and foremost is to formulate as far as we can an analytic theory and a theoretical framework for thinking about conical intersection structure and dynamics and the influence of an environment on those things. Now, I need to say that there's a major industry now in computer simulation of conical intersection dynamics. Some of those simulations are done in complex environments, proteins or solutions. I take it, and there are many, many talented people doing those. Mike Robb in the UK is one. Todd Martinez in Illinois is another one. Let me just try to give you a perspective of why I consider the first thing to be important. So, Todd Martinez, who's an extremely talented and bright guy, does these simulations in these complex environments, and he admits, doesn't know how to interpret his results. He doesn't know how to think about the influence of an environment on these things. And what we would like to do is to provide that kind of framework. Now, our long-term goal is to do this both for our solution environment, let's say in water, and then in proteins, but we haven't even finished this yet. This is what I'll focus on today. And what we would like to get out of this, first of all, is insight. Function of theory is to teach us how to think, I believe. We'd like to make some transitions for what these timescales are going to be, what the pathways are, how these processes occur to help interpret the experiments and the simulations. Okay, so those are the goals. Now I'm going to focus today as an illustration on, again, a cis-trans isomerization in the excited electronic state in molecules that are called protonated shift bases. Doesn't matter what they're called, but the basic reaction is in the excited electronic state, you have an isomerization around a certain double bond. The reason for the interest in this is twofold. The first is that I mentioned Mike Robb a little bit earlier and his collaborator Olivucci in Siena have done a lot of excited electronic state structure calculations on these types of molecules in the vacuum. excited electronic structure state calculations are terrible. They're extremely difficult to do correctly, but fortunately, people like Mike Robb and Mario Olavucci exist, and they've done this, so they're going to give us a lot of information that we could use or extract ruthlessly from their work to think about the problem in an environment. So that's the first reason for the choice. The second reason for the choice is that this is a well-accepted model for cis-trans isomerization in the retinol molecule, which is connected to vision, how we see. Differs a bit over here and over here, but the working part is essentially the same. Now, as I mentioned, Mike Robb and did I say Mario? It's Massimo Olavucci, have already done some work that will help us for the molecule in the vacuum. Now, you might say, well, in order to do a cis-trans isomerization, what I want to think about is simply the twist coordinate. But I've already warned you that we have to think about, even in the vacuum, more than one coordinate to get a conical intersection. And what that means physically is the following. So I'm not showing you the ground electronic state. Here's a calculated excited state surface. There's a higher electronic state that won't worry us today. So one comes up in the laser excitation in a Frank-Condon transition up to here. And you say, what's the problem? Let's just isomerize. Let's just rotate. But you've got that double bond there. Okay. And that's going to prevent you from isomerizing. So what you have to do first is move in a structural bond length coordinate in the molecule to take the shorter double bond length, increase it to something more like a single bond length, and correspondingly, the former single bond lengths in the molecule then compress towards double bond lengths. Now, once that happens, then the molecule says, oh, gee, this looks like a single bond. It's going to be easy for me to rotate and isomerize. So that's the idea.
Is this happening locally, or is this happening in
focal field? It's focused locally. In the double bond, which is the scene of the crime, and then a couple bonds on either side. I mean, it doesn't go forever. So the first step that these calculations tell us is you have to move in this stretching coordinate, technically called the bond length alternation coordinate, which we'll call R from now on. And then once you've done that, then you can move, then you can start to twist and go down and reach the conical intersection. So that gives us an important piece of information to start with. So now let's talk about the ingredients that we're going to use to try to describe what's going on in solution. Okay. Well, first of all, we already know from the vacuum, as I just indicated to you, that we need these two. The bond stretch coordinate and the twisting coordinate, the torsional coordinate. We have to have those. There's one more we're going to have, and to set that up, we have to ask the question, why should it matter for this process that you're in an environment like water or acetonitrile or a protein environment for that matter? And the reason is there's charge transfer all over the place in this process. Okay. The charge distribution in the ground electronic state, and from now on, I take pity on everybody, including myself, and I just draw the double bond part of the molecule, and the rest is just indicated by circles here. So it's a positive charge on the right-hand side of the molecule. I do the laser excitation, and I have a charge transfer, electron transfer from this side to that side. So that transfers the positive charge over there. Okay, this is over quite a few angstroms. So I have a big charge transfer. So then I have to move, as I've already indicated to you, in this bond stretching coordinate. Then I can twist, go through the conical intersection, and I come down on the ground state with the charge distribution the same way it was at the beginning, but now in a trans geometric configuration. And you see that when the smoke is clear to go from here to here, I've got another huge charge transfer. Okay? Now, if this is going on in a polar solvent or a protein environment with charges and polar groups nearby, there's going to be a strong electrostatic coupling involved here because of the charge transfer. So, okay. Secondly, we are going to reduce the complex electronic structure problem to the key ingredients of the process. And this traces back to some work of my Boulder colleague, Joseph Mickel, in the 80s, in terms of two valence bond states. Now, in English, valence bond states basically means that even if we distort them geometrically, they have a fixed type of electronic character or a fixed type of charge distribution. More technically, they're non-adiabatic states. Okay, so here we have the notation has to do with where the electrons are in the bonding system. Okay, AB means there's one on each, and here I've drawn where they are in the p orbitals at the original geometry, in the original planar geometry here. Now, if I twist, notice that these become orthogonal. The other valence bond state is, the notation is B squared. Now, both electrons are over here, and you see in this picture in the planar geometry. And when you twist to 90 degrees, we also get orthogonality. When you put these two features together, it tells you that there's not going to be any coupling between the excited electronic state and the ground electronic state once I go to 90 degree geometry. No electronic coupling at that particular geometry is the condition required for a conical intersection where the upper surface and the ground state surface will touch. Okay. So, all of that is telling us the electronic character of what's involved here. We already know we need the coordinates r and theta, and this charge transfer aspect says we also have to think about a coordinate to describe the solvent, because it's going to be importantly involved in this process. Right. The important type of interaction with a polar solvent is going to be electrostatic. Okay, we're moving charge around in the reaction system. That's going to couple, and here I'm talking in terms of a dielectric continuum perspective, in terms of the nuclear polarization of the solvent. In English, basically that is associated with the local dipole moment density at different parts of the solvent. And we can characterize the state of that polarization in a way that it introduces what I'll call the solvent coordinate S, is the actual polarization at some field point in the solvent, looking more like the equilibrium polarization if I had the charge distribution one way or the charge distribution the other way. These are the charge distributions of the two VV states. Now with that, you can turn the problem into a Hamiltonian description as follows. I'll just talk my way through this lightly. I'm not going to go into all bunch of detail. Certainly, we have to think about the kinetic energy associated with intramolecular. What can't you read well, Javon? This one. Yeah. Okay. This is the polarization, electrical polarization, that would exist in the solvent if the positive charge was over here. The second one is the polarization that would be in equilibrium with the other charge distribution, which is where the positive charge is over here. Okay? And the general description of the polarization is somewhere in between, not necessarily in equilibrium with either one of them. But Giovanni's question reminds me to emphasize, and it will become more clear as we go along, that it's going to be very important for us to take into account the fact that the electric polarization of the solvent doesn't have to be in equilibrium with the charge distribution of the isomerizing molecule. You've already seen that the time scales for these isomerizations could be a few hundreds of picoseconds. Okay. Water, which is a very fast solvent, simply because to change its dipole, it's only got to move light hydrogens around, is going to be hard-pressed to keep up with that. Even that solvent is going to be hard-pressed to keep up in equilibrium with such a rapidly changing charge distribution. So the whole description has to take into account fundamentally that the solvent polarization is going to be out of equilibrium with the charge distribution inside the molecule. Okay, so it's a Hamiltonian, and so we have the kinetic energy of the two intramolecular coordinates, the kinetic energy of the solvent coordinate. Uh-huh. And then the effective potential energy is essentially constructed from the two valence bond states that I've described. Here's and the electronic coupling between them. Now let me go through this. In the vacuum, this would be the potential with a positive charge. Let me remind myself where the positive charge is there. The positive charge on the right. Okay. Now, if the solvent were equilibrated to that charge distribution, we'd have some equilibrium solvation free energy. But in general, we're not out of equilibrium, and it's well known that a very good approximation under most circumstances is that the deviation from equilibrium goes quadratically in a solvent coordinate. And this is the force constant measuring how hard that is. There's a similar equation for the other valence bond state. Okay. And the electronic coupling between them, which has the key property we need to know today, is that it has this form and it vanishes at 90 degrees to allow for the conical intersection to occur. Okay. I will simply say, I'll describe more in a minute, but let me say for the moment, that at this level of description, there's no dissipation. There's dynamics of the solvent, but it's an inertial dynamics, and I'll say what that means in a moment. Now, I want to make two types of comments about this type of description. This formulation in terms of valence bond states is particularly convenient for describing the evolving non-equilibrium interaction of a solvent polarization field with an evolving charge distribution in a molecule. Why is that? Now, you might say, well, let's do the following. Let's figure out the electronic structure problem in the vacuum, in the absence of the solvent. Then we would get some linear combination for the electronically adiabatic states mixed by this coupling, some linear combination of the two VV states with coefficients that would depend upon the geometry coordinates of the molecule in the vacuum. And so we could say, well, okay, we now finished the electronic structure part. Let's now solvate that. That would be wrong, because what will really happen in solution is that there's a competition going on. The electronic coupling would like to mix these two states together, and that's the only effect in the vacuum. But in solution, the solvent dipoles could be arranged such that they might prefer to see the charge distribution associated with this and not with that, and so that would shift the electronic structure over in a different way. And what you have to have is a formulation that lets those two effects fight it all out to find out what the answer is. Okay? And that's very conveniently done in this formulation. The price to pay is that the electronic wave function in solution is again a linear combination of the two VV states, but the weights, the coefficients, now also depend upon what the polarization state of the solvent is. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is, I just said something about non-dissipative inertial dynamics for the solvent. What does that mean? Let me talk about that now, and this will help you get, I hope, a clearer picture of a solvent coordinate. So I'm going to take a slight detour, and I'm going to talk about a different problem, which is the way that one can experimentally study solvation dynamics. And that's to take a dye in solution. In its ground electronic state, let's suppose it has no dipole moment. And we're going to do an excitation to the excited state where the dipole moment is changed. Okay, these experiments are done all the time. Now, if the solvent is in equilibrium with the ground state dye molecule with no dipole moment, the dipoles will be arranged at random if the solvent is in equilibrium. But there are fluctuations in the solvent all the time, right? We can have some dipoles lining up this way on that side, lining up this on this side, and those fluctuations raise the free energy. And that's this type of quadratic curve I wrote down two transparencies ago. There's a similar curve for the excited electronic state, so we have this picture in the solvent coordinate. So now we do the excitation. We change the charge distribution in the dye molecule. You're the solvent molecule. What do you think about this? Well, you're not so happy. Because of the Frank Condon principle, you've changed the electronic distribution in the molecule to create this big dipole, but the nuclei of the, let's say, water molecule can't move. So they're stuck in the same configuration as they were in the ground state. But that's an unstable situation because the solvent would like to be in equilibrium with this new charge distribution. So in this type of picture, that means one is going to have motion along the solvent coordinate to come down in equilibrium. But these dye molecules have the nice property that they're fluorescent. Okay, and if one can monitor the fluorescence frequency as a function of time, which one can now experimentally, you have a way to follow in time the solvation dynamics as the solvent equilibrates to the new charge distribution that's been created. And when you do that, you see that the dynamics is bimodal. A very short time part is Gaussian in time. And then there's a longer dissipated part that can go out to, let's say, a picosecond or 2 picoseconds. This part here is what I called inertial dynamics. Inertial dynamics means the following. I create a new charge distribution. Okay. The solvent molecules initially do not react. Well, what would they do? They already have a distribution of momenta or velocities. And at the shortest time, that's the only thing that counts. By the motion that the solvent molecules already have, they will change their position. And that means that the gap will change between the two of the electronic states. That is this Gaussian part. And that's the dynamics we are including. We are not including the longer time dissipative dynamics. Why is that? Because the time scale for this stuff is in the femtosecond range, and that's the time scale we need for the conical intersection problem. This is going to be irrelevant. We'll see about that later, but that's the idea. And what this time is varies from solvent to solvent. It's about 100 femtoseconds for water, about 3 times longer for acetonitrile molecule. Okay, so now I've told you all the ingredients. What time did I start? You counted your time too, I believe. C'est pas possible. Okay. All right. So, I told you we already knew about the vacuum problem, so we can figure out what the surfaces look like in the vacuum from Mike Rob's work, and there's the conical intersection located in the stretch coordinates and the twisting coordinate at 90 degrees. Now let's put it in a solvent, in the solvent I've described to you. We need some dynamics of the solvent in this problem, and now we're going to see why. Because let's consider the simplified case where we do the transition from the ground electronic state, which has this charge distribution, the positive charge on the right-hand side. Here's a picture of the equilibrium solvation there. And in the Frank-Condon transition, we will not let those guys move. And now let's keep them there. Let's just not let them move and see what happens. Well, the conical intersection that existed in the gas phase has now disappeared. Completely disappeared. Okay. Let me do a different case. Let's now say, okay, after the Frank-Condon transition out of this state to the excited state, let's let the solvent instantly equilibrate to the new charge distribution, but then keep it frozen there. Then what you see is that the conical intersection now exists, but it doesn't look like it looked in the gas phase. It's been shifted and distorted. Let me explain why this one happened. I don't have time if I only have minutes. I can explain to you why that happened. I've just showed you that I can get different situations for different values of the solvent coordinate. And if you go through the entire analysis, what you see is, in fact, there's an entire seam of solvent coordinates. The free energy along that seam looks like this. And here's the projection onto the solvent coordinate and the geometric coordinate plane. So there are all kinds of conical intersections along this seam. So in the case where we didn't allow the solvent to, if we do the Frank-Condon transition, the solvent is in the polarization appropriate to the ground state, there's no conical intersection. Somehow we've got to move in the solvent to get to this seam to do the transition. Now, we worked out a long time ago how to find minimum energy paths on surfaces like this, and I won't go through the details, I'll just show you what they look like. I have two cases here. A light solvent is something like water. A heavy solvent is something like acetonitrile. Okay? Acetonitrile is slower in its inertial solvent dynamics than water. What's the path look like on the way to the seam? For the heavy solvent, the first thing that happens is I have to move in the bond stretch coordinate, and then finally in the slow solvent I will reach this conical intersection seam. The general rule is that the fastest coordinate goes first and the slowest coordinate comes last. If I have a light solvent on the other hand, what happens, I move a little bit in an R, but I have a huge motion in the solvent coordinate, it's so fast. And then I approach the seam by moving in the geometric coordinate. So the pathways to the seam depend strongly on the dynamical characteristics of the solvent. So now we do some dynamics, and I only have time enough to show you this part. What I'm showing you is, with this full dynamical description of the system and the solvent, we're now going to calculate by a certain wave packet technique what's the probability of remaining in the excited electronic state as a function of time. Here's what happens for the heavy solvent. It's very slow getting out of the excited state. The light solvent is very fast getting out of the excited electronic state. Okay, what are the pathways followed in that? And I remind you, here are these minimum energy pathways that we've already calculated. Let's look at the heavy solvent again. First you move in the geometrical stretch, and then finally you move in the solvent coordinate. These are the dynamical results, and you see that basically that's what happens. First you move in the stretch, there's some oscillations in the stretch, okay, and then you approach the conical intersection seam in the solvent coordinate. That's good. What happens for the light solvent, something like water? You moved a little bit in R, but the main initial motion was in the solvent coordinates, and then finally you approached in the geometric coordinate. What does the dynamic say? Well, it's this picture. And what you see is it's kind of a mess in the dynamic. You move a bit in R, and then you move a lot in the solvent, but there are oscillations all over the place, including in the solvent coordinate. That's a sign of trouble. And here's the next sign of trouble. Here are the angular distributions that come out of the wave packet calculations. At time t equal to zero, you're located in the planar geometry. And as time goes on, you're going to head towards the twisted geometry, and that's what's happening. So far, so good, but you see what happens here. The molecule is going all the way around. So the problem is obvious for the light solvent. There's no real problem for the heavy solvent, but for the light solvent problem, we have to go back and put some kind of frictional damping on the solvent and the other coordinates. And you can't go and use some ohmic friction or anything like that. The time scale for the whole problem is so short, one needs a detailed time-dependent friction analysis, and that's where we are at the moment. So I see my doom has come upon me, cried the Lady of Shalott. Okay, obviously we have a long way to go, even though I think we've made quite a bit of progress. We have to include some damping on the various modes, at least for a light solvent like water. And then I believe that what we will see is dynamics that's quite similar to the minimum energy path that I showed you. There's further work, one we are doing, not finished, is what is the rate constant for actually going through that conical intersection itself? That's a generalization of Landau-Zenner, if anyone knows what Landau-Zenner is. And then we have to go, since we really want to do protein environments, we can't get away with a dielectric continuum, but there's something called the Poisson-Boltzmann description, which takes into account the inhomogeneous charge distribution of an environment, and we can use that. So that's where we're going. So, thanks again to the organizers. Thanks to Ray and Stu for being 65, among other things. Thanks again to my colleagues here for their help, and finally, thanks to you for your attention.